You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with two anti-drone activists, Eleanor Levine and Jerry Monroe Maynard, about the work they're doing at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada and throughout the U.S. to stop drone warfare.
The selling, the use, and the promotion of drones helps to perpetuate this false idea that we have the right to dominate the world, to dominate other people who don't look like us, or who maybe don't even agree with us. And so we have to really, really challenge that idea. And part of the way we do that is to say that we don't want to cooperate with things that are anti-human. And I think drones are anti-human.
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Kwe nidaps nidabesks aguanu. Hello, friends. Welcome. I'm coming to you from my home in the rainy and cloudy Dawnland here in Bunawabskeg territory, in and along the shores of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine. It's been raining here for days. I've been traveling for about a month in sunny parts of the country and have returned a few days ago. And every day since I've been here, it's been raining, and it looks like it's going to be raining for a long time. The good news is that everything is becoming bright, bright green, which I love to see. And I'm joined by my wonderful co-host who always brings the sun, Miss Rivera Sun. Hi, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. Well, it's always a delight to get on the airwaves with you and take a look at what's going on in the movement of movements at some angle or another, because we know all of our friends and colleagues out there are always up to beautiful trouble. Today we're going to be looking at an issue that predates the current crisis around the Trump administration quite a bit and goes back through the administrations. We're going to look at drones and drone warfare. And to do that, we're going to speak with two activists who've been working on this issue. One some of you listeners may remember is Jerry Monroe Maynard, who is the organizer of Campaign Nonviolence Houston in Texas. He's also a Catholic peace activist and a member of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, USA. Joining him and us is Eleanor Levine, who is a longtime activist with Code Pink, Women for Peace, and her main interest is in combating militarism and replacing it with peace. She works on this issue both abroad and domestically here at home. So, Eleanor and Jerry, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for having me. I'm always happy to be with y'all.
Well, Eleanor and Jerry, it's wonderful to have you with us and to highlight the important work that you're doing. As we know, this has become a larger and larger problem, and it's continuing to grow. And so I think it's really important for our listeners to kind of get a grasp on where things are and what we're looking at in regard to drones here in the U.S. and abroad. So my first question is, how did you come to this work and what does it entail? So just kind of laying the foundation for our listeners so they can get a scope of what it is you're doing. And we can start with Jerry.
So I came to the realization about drones just through my anti-war work, working to abolish war and nuclear weapons and militarism in our society. And I stumbled upon drones because of Medea Benjamin, because she wrote a book a couple of years ago on drones. And I remember when I found out about it, I bought the book and I read it and I started doing more research. And then Jeremy Stahill wrote a book on drones as well. And I have that book as well. And when I learned more about it and did a lot more research, I was like, well, this needs to be addressed and we need to get involved in this. And this seems to be not just bad because of what they're doing, but it also seems to be very much opposed to humanity. And I, as a Catholic peace activist, part of my activism stems from my faith in that every person is made in the image and likeness of God. And so my working to end war and drones comes out of that belief that we need to safeguard each and every life, human and non-human life. And so it really came from predominantly from those two books, Medea's book and Jeremy's book.
Great. And how about you, Eleanor? What drew you into this work?
Well, it's a complicated answer because I think the answer changes from time to time. But I'll say that my main interest began with issues of warfare at home, domestic unfairness, civil rights. And as the war in Vietnam progressed, I was coming of age as an adult and got involved in the anti-war movement and the peace movement and have never stopped. I saw parallels between what was going on at home and abroad and got involved in the women's movement, hence Code Pink Women for Peace. And combating drones and warfare and bringing peace is one of the mainstays of Code Pink's program.
So what does the work that you're doing right now look like, Eleanor?
Well, I do a number of different things. I'm very involved in our work around Creech Air Force Base, which, as many people know, is located in Nevada. It's about 100 miles north of Las Vegas. It's the center of drone warfare. It's the place from which pilots sit in little booths with their operators and give commands for drones to drop missiles in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, and other countries in that region. So I'm involved in our campaign to stop the drones and end the drones, particularly those that are flown from Creech Air Force Base and Beale Air Force Base, which is in Northern California. We go to Creech Air Force Base twice a year. We have protests. We organize. We bring together different groups across the country, including Veterans for Peace, Voices for Creative Nonviolence, Nevada Desert Experience, and certainly Code Pink. And our goal there is to educate people in Las Vegas. Our goal is to stop the drones. Our goal is to appeal to the military personnel and the civilians who are going out of Creech Air Force Base. And that's what we do. It's a big job. It's a lot of work. But we think we are increasingly effective. Certainly many more people understand what drones are about and what drone warfare is about. And we'd like to think that the work that we do is the cause of that. I also want to add that I work at home with the Stop Urban Shield Coalition, which is a coalition of groups, including Code Pink, that is addressing the militarization of disaster preparedness. And that involves Urban Shield is a program that's run by various counties in the United States, including the county in which I live, which is Alameda County. And it involves training local first responders in a militaristic approach to any kind of a disaster, including floods, earthquakes, fires, and so on. And it is essentially preparing first responders to treat any kind of disaster as if it was a terrorist attack. And that's exactly what we're doing with our military. We're treating every kind of uprising and every kind of protest and every kind of demand for national sovereignty, particularly in poor countries around the world, as if these are terrorist organizations, when in fact the people who are rising up are simply asking for the right to grow their own food, the right to have clean water, the right to educate their children, and the right to go about their daily lives in a peaceful and sensible way.
I think that's one of the interesting things about the drone issue as well, is that One of the long-lasting concerns and that we have unfortunately lived to see come into reality is how what we start to use overseas comes home domestically. So in the course of the work that's been done to raise awareness about drones, we have gone from the rhetoric being, oh no, we're only going to use these overseas, and in fact the original drone usage being only surveillance, to having those drones be armed overseas and be used as weapons overseas. And now we do see the surveillance drone use coming home to our police departments, our Homeland Security, and we do also have the rise of pressure, it's not public yet, but the pressure to allow corporate delivery drones, so private drone carriers, such as those that Amazon is wishing and the Amazon is using and test piloting on its own warehouse campuses. Jerry, I'd love to ask you your thoughts on that overlap, but also what does the work look like when you get on the ground at Creech? What does it actually entail in the details? Do you stand out with signs? What is actually the work that you do there?
Well, the collective work that we do while we're at Creech, we're there for about a week, and we have a varying number of things that we do. But what we do every day is we gather early in the morning when drone operators and other people who work on the base are driving into work, and we have a vigil outside of the entrances of the base. We do that in the morning, and then we do that in the afternoon, again, when people are getting ready to leave. There is one day in the week where we have a day of mass action, where people do different things like blockading, die-ins, things like that. And then besides that, we also have, like last year, we did a symposium where we had former drone operators come and speak about their experiences, and Wright gave some talks and other things like that. But we mostly tried to help build awareness and to resist the day-to-day operations that happen there at Creech. My job in particular is that I sit on the outreach committee, so I try to help build awareness in other places, like in Houston, about drones and encourage people to come to shut down Creech. And then when I'm actually on the ground, I facilitate the nonviolence training that happens in the campsite for all people who are in attendance, but especially for people who are going to do nonviolent direct action.
I'd add, if I might, that the drone operators and all the other military personnel stream in between 6 and 8 in the morning, and they stream out of the base between 3 and 5. And that's when we vigil along the roadway that leads to the main entrance of the gate. We have signs, we have banners, we have chants, and we're out there with signs, and the signs change daily so that people see a different message. And our main goal is to get the drone operators to stop flying the drones. And I think between us and the demands of the drone operators, the Air Force is having a hard time getting drone operators. The number of operators has dropped, and they're having a hard time retaining and recruiting drone operators. It's a nasty, dirty job.
So in addition to having these protests, what other activities are you engaged in that are actively trying to prevent drones from being used? The pressure certainly being put on the operators with public scrutiny around the use of drones is one tactic. Are there other things that you're doing to actually influence the ability to use drones in the public sphere? Or do you have aspirations of doing more?
Well, we certainly do a lot of public speaking. That's one of the things we do to educate people, because that's one of the most important things, is for people to be educated. I would say that 95% of the people in Las Vegas have no idea there's a drone base 100 miles north of Las Vegas. So we are really trying to do more education. I would like to see us do more education in that area, that geographic area, so that we increase the number of allies we have who are working with us on the anti-drone work. But as I said, we do a lot of speaking and we do a lot of education, and I would say that's probably at our end what we do besides being present at some of the bases.
One of the questions that I'm wondering about, you mentioned, Eleanor, that drone warfare is a dirty job, but the question that's also coming to mind is, I've heard that every time we use a drone to strike out a terrorist, we create 10 more terrorists. Why is this? What is this phenomenon that is turning into a vicious cycle that actually is perhaps demonstrating that drone warfare is not necessarily accomplishing the task in the long run?
Well, I would say that most people in the United States, because I talk to a lot of people and so do all of my colleagues, think that drone warfare or drone strikes are a safe form of war because the pilot is protected. The pilot is unknown. The pilot is protected, sits in a little booth at someplace like Creech Air Force Base or Hancock Base in Syracuse, New York. And so people say it's safe because our Air Force members are safer. But it's not safe in the long run because you can imagine what it's like. A drone takes to the sky. It drops a payload of Hellfire missiles. Our guess, and so is the guess for people who are really knowledgeable, is that anywhere between 80 to 90% of the targets that are actually hit are not the intended targets. And you go out for a picnic, suppose you're in Afghanistan, you're in Yemen, which is where the most fierce droning is now occurring. You go out with your family for a picnic, you're with your aunts, your uncles, your children, your grandchildren, friends, and all of a sudden the buzzing begins, and the buzzing is incessant, as people describe it to us. And then the Hellfire missiles are dropped, and most of your picnic party is wiped out. And this happens daily. It happens at night. Of course, one's not picnicking at night, but it happens during the night and it happens during the day. And how would you feel if you lived in a community where you had done nothing but go out for a picnic and somebody is dropping Hellfire missiles on you? You would be angry, you would be upset, and you would be tempted to join the resistance. And that's what's happening around the world. We are building more enemies than we are friends by the kinds of drone actions that we've engaged in. So in the long run, they're not safe. They are not in our national interest.
They're also really inhumane. When we think about the use of drone warfare, you know, we're further distancing ourselves from the reality of our actions. And so, you know, it used to be very, very different. My friend Paul Chappelle talks about this a lot in his workshops, where being engaged in hand-to-hand combat, that people were a lot less likely to kill somebody if they had to look them in the eye. And the further we've taken ourselves away from the actual act of killing, of actually having to be present to look the other person in the eye that we're harming, the further we've distanced ourselves, the easier it's become for us to kill larger numbers of people. And so when we think about the dynamic that's at play here, it's actually taking away our humanity. And so we have to look at how drone warfare is further distancing us from one another as human beings. It's further distancing us from the reality of death, from facing the consequences of our own actions. And do you do any education around that distancing process as part of the work that you're doing? And do people understand the correlation between distancing and the ability to more easily take life, to stop considering the sacredness of life, the value of life, that it makes us easier to separate it? It's almost like kids playing a video game.
I think it's a really interesting dynamic. This year at Creech, we had two film screenings. We showed a documentary called National Bird two nights during the week while we were in Las Vegas. And we had two former drone operators come who are whistleblowers. And I had dinner with them after the second film screening. And sitting at the table having a conversation with them and drinking coffee and eating, I had the sudden realization that looking at them and interacting with them that it's so obvious that they are suffering from PTSD and different variant forms. And I suddenly had the realization while I was sitting there that, you know, yeah, there is a distance, but I think that the impact of war is still the same. It's a little bit different because of the distance, and it's a little bit different because of the technology, but it's still the same. Because ultimately what comes down to it is that human beings were not created to kill other human beings. That's why so many drone operators have nightmares when they go to sleep or have shaking fits during the day. And I have a good friend of mine who is a former drone operator, and he sent me a message because I asked him to explain to me how he felt about being a former drone operator. And he told me that it's something that very, very much common people don't understand, that you, even though you are sitting in front of a screen and you're killing somebody miles and miles and miles away, the actual fact that you see the person dying on the screen still implants into your soul the horrible effects of destroying another life. So I think it's a dynamic that's very strange. And I think ultimately what will come down to the abolition of drones and drone warfare and warfare in general is the realization that we're just not created to destroy and to murder, and we need to best facilitate the creation of a world where that no longer exists, or maybe not even just exists, but where people actually don't even think that it's necessary to have.
That's kind of one of the interesting catch-22s of the drones, is that the rationale for using them is often to, you know, lower our U.S. soldier casualty rate. But when we look at the effects of PTSD on our soldiers and the fact that we have 22 veterans per day committing suicide, it's almost like our casualty rate is simply delayed. And that if the effects of drone warfare are the same as hand-to-hand combat, then we aren't actually protecting our soldiers anymore. What we are doing, however, is fueling that rage and that sense of powerlessness that leads to extreme conflicts rising over and over again. So I'm curious, maybe Eleanor, you could start with an answer to this, and Jerry, if you want to chime in afterwards, that'd be great. What do we see brewing in terms of the shifts in the administration, either the military or the civilian administration, around the use of drones? Has that shifted at all since you began campaigning, or is that still fairly entrenched?
I would say it's escalated. From 2002 to 2017, the number of drone, if you can call them sorties or missile firings, has increased, and it is increasing at a rapid rate. So I don't think it's decreased. And it's frightening. I think it's frightening to me. It's frightening to young people in this country. And it's certainly frightening to the people who are being droned, to live under the incessant sound of drones day and night. There is no reprieve. One of the things I want to add, because I think this is very telling, when we were at a creech, I talked to a passerby, and the fellow said to me when I asked him, "Don't you care about drone warfare? Don't you care about what's going on?" And he said to me, "I don't care." And I said, "You don't care?" He said, "I don't care." And he repeated it several times. And for me, that's a sign that we've so distanced our population in the United States from what we're doing abroad that people simply don't care. And they're simply, it's not just that people are not aware, they just don't feel a responsibility for what we're doing. And I find that really frightening. And the more that we engage in remote warfare, the more that sense that I'm not responsible will grow. And that's a frightening thought.
I want to just add one thing there, because I think Eleanor said a key word, and that's responsibility. We have created a culture now where we think that it's, as long as it doesn't affect me directly or doesn't affect the people I love or care about, I'm not responsible for it. And so as long as my bubble is protected from being popped, I don't care what happens, as long as my bubble is protected. And I think the culture of violence that we live in, you know, Rivera and I have a good friend, John Deere, who likes to say that we are all addicted to violence and that we all need to join a 12-step program and say, "I'm Jerry, I'm addicted to violence, and I want to recover from this violence." I think our culture has created this belief that we don't have to be responsible for other lives. And it's quite ironic that we, a couple of years ago, were arguing about whether or not all lives matter or if Black lives matter. And all the Republicans and privileged white people who are heterosexual all said, oh, yeah, of course all lives matter. But the peace and justice community said, well, yeah, of course all lives matter. But as long as we live in this culture of violence where the Black lives, the brown lives, the Muslim lives, the queer lives are threatened, that's a lie. It's not true. So I think to combat drone warfare, war, and this culture of violence, we have to begin to start teaching in our societies, our churches, our schools, that we are responsible for one another, that solidarity is what will save us.
You know, I want to go back to what Eleanor said, because it actually speaks to what I was asking earlier about the individual who said that they don't care. That's the exact type of distancing that I'm talking about, where it's not actually right in front of us. We're not suffering the consequences of it, so we don't feel any sense of responsibility toward it. One of the things that I think is problematic about the whole sense of responsibility that's lacking within the majority of our societies is that we have placed this value system, embedded it into our cultural realities, our social realities, as part of our social agreements. We're all complicit in the supporting of these value structures that place profit above the value of life. And so when we start looking at the types of things that are going on, as long as the economy keeps chugging along and people are able to continue to live under this illusion of freedom, without having any consequences for the actions that this government is taking on behalf of its people, then they don't have to take any responsibility for it. But one day that responsibility is going to come calling. It's going to show up here on our doorsteps. And so how do we get people to acknowledge that they have a responsibility toward the actions that this government takes on their behalf? How do we get them to start looking at their buy-in, their complicity with the system that exists, by allowing profit to be valued higher than life? And so, you know, when we start looking at all of these structures and systems that are in place right now that we have all been complicit in creating and supporting, how do we begin to change those underlying value structures and to balance this right that we want to claim to have a safe life with our responsibility to ensure that all others have a safe life? How do we start doing that work under the surface in order to make sure that all of the other work that we're doing actually is able to saturate within our society and become a new way of being rather than an aspirational ideal?
Well, it's a tough road. But one of the nice things that President Trump has done is to motivate and activate a lot of people in this country around issues such as medical care, women's rights, reproductive rights, and you name it, and it's there. And I think one of the challenges that many of us will see in front of us is to activate that base to see the connection between the things that they're losing and where the money is going. Something like 58% of our discretionary budget, and that's increasing, is going to military. And that's a lot of money, and that will increase. If we can get people to see the connection between who's profiting from war and their loss of daily supports, I think we'll do a lot better. And if we can get people to understand that there are certain people who are directly profiting from their losses, like Boeing, Lockheed, Raytheon, Martin Marietta, and Israeli Air Force, some of the British munitions companies, and so on. If we can draw those parallels and to show where the money is going, who's profiting. Raytheon stock increased tremendously after President Trump was inaugurated. They know where the money's going, and so it's our job and the job of other people who are involved in the push for single payer, the job of people who are involved in women's rights, reproductive rights, involved in protecting job worker safety, and so on, to really begin to draw on the parallels between where the money is going, where it's headed now, and that they are the losers as a result. And in fact, the money is really going to military. Besides the pockets of the wealthy, it's also going to the military, and we really need to work on it.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence. Nonviolence Minute, we're going to do something a little bit different, and that is to embody the strategies of creative nonviolence that Kathy Kelly and Medea Benjamin and people like Jerry and Eleanor use in their work to stop drone warfare. We're going to share an excerpt from Medea Benjamin's book, which is called Drone Warfare: Killing by Remote Control, which shares a true story of someone whose life had been severely affected by the use of drones. In the introduction to the book, Medea Benjamin writes, "I met Roya on my first day while visiting the Pakistan-Afghan border on a dusty road in Peshawar. It was just weeks after the 2002 U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, and I was traveling as a representative of the human rights group I co-founded called Global Exchange. A young girl approached me, her head cocked to one side, her hand outstretched, begging for money. With the help of an interpreter, I learned her story. Roya was 13 years old, the same age as my youngest daughter. But her life could not have been in starker contrast to that of my San Francisco high schooler and her girlfriends. Roya never had time for sports or for school. Born into a poor family living on the outskirts of Kabul, her father was a street vendor. Her mother raised 5 children and baked sweets for him to sell. One day, while her father was out selling candies, Roya and her 2 sisters were trudging home carrying buckets of water. Suddenly, they heard a terrifying whir, and then there was an explosion. Something terrible had dropped from the sky, tearing their house apart and sending the body parts of their mother and 2 brothers flying through the air. The Americans must have thought Roya's home was part of a nearby Taliban housing compound. In the cold vernacular of military speak, her family had become collateral damage in America's war on terror. When Roya's father came home, he carefully collected all the bits and pieces of his pulverized family that he could find, buried them immediately according to Islamic tradition, and then sank into a severe state of shock. Roya became head of her household. She bundled up her surviving sisters, grabbed her father, and fled. With no money or provisions, they trekked to the Hindu Kush, across the Khyber Pass, and into Pakistan. Once in Peshawar, the family barely survived on the $1 a day the girls made from begging. Roya took me to their one-room adobe hut to meet her father. A tall, strong man with the calloused hands of a hard worker, he no longer works. He doesn't even talk or walk. He just sits and stares into space. Once in a while, he smiles, Roya whispered. Inside Afghanistan, I saw more lives destroyed by U.S. bombs. Some bombs hit the right target but caused horrific collateral damage. Some bombs hit the wrong target because of human error, machine malfunction, or faulty information. The American government told the public not to worry about who was on the receiving end of their air attacks. The U.S. military now had smart bombs and laser-guided missiles that, together with a newfangled kind of unmanned plane called drones, gave them the capability of dropping munitions with breathtaking precision. Government officials insisted that civilian casualties would be carefully avoided. When I realized this was a lie, I vowed I would try to get the U.S. government to help compensate these innocent victims of our attacks. I also vowed that I would never allow myself to be lulled into thinking that high-tech wars were somehow more humane." Medea Benjamin dedicated her book to Roya and to all the innocent victims of drone warfare. And now let's return to our program. And so, Jerry, I wanted to ask you to comment a little bit on the intersectionality of drone warfare and the militarism, but also, I know, Eleanor, this is a theme of yours, so maybe we'll get back to you on this question as well. How are the movements, in your view, making the connections between militarism abroad and militarism at home? I know that there's been some good work done, and maybe you could articulate some of that, Jerry, and where else could we be increasing our understanding of how it all relates?
Well, I think some organizations have been doing well, like Veterans for Peace, at making the connections about what happens outside of our borders, which then affects our borders, then which affects what happens within our borders. I think Campaign Nonviolence is really good at talking about connecting the dots and creating a culture of justice and mainstreaming nonviolence. But I think as a whole, our social justice movements still have not really totally got the concept of intersectionality, especially when it comes to war and militarism. But I think drones is a topic that's really good for intersectionality because it's a direct byproduct of our racist system, because the people that we're killing with drones are Muslim people, predominantly people of color. In Dallas, when we had the Dallas shooting, the Dallas Police Department used a drone to find the active shooter who shot on the crowd and the officers. And when they found him with the drone, they blew him up with a bomb. And a lot of police departments now are getting grants from the government to buy drones, to use drones as part of their warfare on people of color. I think drones relate to the destruction of the environment, because every time we use a drone to attack people, it pollutes the ground, which then destroys cultures, because many of the places that we bomb with our drones no longer can grow food because the ground is polluted. And then we have situations like Yemen, where we have created a humanitarian crisis with our drones by creating starvation in that country. So I think it's a issue that really has many, many facets to it, and many people can get involved. Those who are part of the BDS movement should be very much involved with drones, because Israel is the number one contributor to drones in the world. They build many, many drone parts that are used to create drones, and drones have been used in places like Gaza to further the occupation of the Palestinians. So I think connecting the dots and showing that our issues are not singular issues, what happens here inside our borders, what happens at our borders, are direct byproducts of what happens outside of this country. That whenever we wage war, it always comes back 10 times fold here. And really, drones and what's happening to people of color and the environment are all direct byproducts of this false idea that we have the right to dominate the world. And so we need to challenge this mentality. And I think one of the things that you said earlier about, that Eleanor was talking about in regards to money, I think our movements really need to make non-cooperation a part of our strategies, that we need to take our money and we need to stop paying for war and redirect that money to institutions that actually better society. And we need to help create a way for drone operators to actually be able to quit their jobs and still be able to make a living. So I think non-cooperation should be a very big part of our strategies and will really help intersect on our issues.
This whole concept of creating opportunities for those who are engaged in harmful career pathways to move is something that we talk about a lot, about, you know, we do have a responsibility to create opportunities for those who are making a living doing things that are harmful to actually switch to careers that allow them to do something that contributes more meaningfully to the protection and the sustaining of life. So I think that that's an important point. I also want to talk about how drones are being used on a regular basis now to surveil activists, to surveil civil resistance and protective stances that people are making towards protecting the waterways, protecting human rights, civil rights, protecting life. So they're being used in a lot of ways outside of the military in civil society. And so when we look at the proliferation of drone use within the civil society, do you see that as being an acceptable use of drones, or do you see that as being potentially problematic because it's actually creating a kind of flood in our airways of drone use that may end up coming back to harm us in some tangible ways? I mean, it's already been harmful to those who are seeking to stand up and honor their constitutional right to stand up and to gather peaceably to protest or to engage in a protective stance. And the use of drones is already an infringement on the rights of those people and also on the privacy of U.S. citizens. So what are your thoughts on the use of drones within civil society?
Well, drones can be helpful. In a disaster, you can find somebody who's lost in the woods. You can find somebody who's in a region that's inaccessible. You can look into something to help a rescue mission. But that's probably at the lower end of drone usage. The usage of drones to surveil and gather intelligence is an intimidation tactic. You collect hours and hours and hours and hours of information about somebody. Who knows who looks at it? Who knows what use is made of that information? Who knows where that information is kept? And it's an intimidation tactic to deny people of their constitutional rights to gather and express protest and free speech. I don't see how else one can look at that, but these are the kinds of intimidation tactics that we've always had, and they're just a case of upping the ante with drones. And this is something that's unacceptable. A lot of people think that I haven't done anything wrong. I'm doing what I am entitled to do. So what's the point? The point is that you don't know what that information is going to be used for, who it's going to be sent to, where it's going to be stored, and in what combination that information might be used to draw a conclusion that has no relationship to reality.
I also think that the use of drones, other than good things like finding people who are lost on mountains or fighting wildfires or things like that, I think using drones for things other than that, I think normalizes violence and domination. You know, if you go to a store, any store in this country, and you look at the electronic section, you will most likely find a drone. And I think because of Amazon and other delivery systems like that, that perpetuate this idea of convenience, I think that relates a lot to our domination of the world, and that we want everything to be done according to our terms, and that the more we see drones being commercially sold in stores and other places like that, helps to perpetuate this idea that we have the right to legislate the way people live their lives. And it also reinforces the idea that we have the right to decide whose lives matter and whose lives matter more than other lives, whether those are human lives or non-human lives. So I think the selling, the use, and the promotion of drones helps to perpetuate this false idea that we have the right to dominate the world, to dominate other people who don't look like us, or who maybe don't even agree with us. And so we have to really, really challenge that idea. And part of the way we do that is to say that we don't want to cooperate with things that are anti-human. And I think drones are anti-human.
You know, I think that there are so many things for us to consider. And I'd like to give people some real practical tools for them to use. So I'd like to ask you, each of you, to answer this briefly. In your experience in talking with people about the use of drones, when you come up against somebody who is very supportive of the use of drones, both for warfare and within the civil society, what are some of the reasons, first, what are some of the reasons that they give for being supportive of drone use? And how do you address those things in order to change their mind or to help them see more broadly about the impact of drones? What are some of the tools and some of the discussions that you open with them in order to help move them into a greater or expanded state of awareness around the use of drones?
I think we all use a variety of approaches depending upon how the conversation is going. Giving information is important. Sometimes people just don't have the correct information, and so giving information is important, but that's not always enough, and it's not always effective, because many times people have an emotional response to statements that militarized drones or weaponized drones are not safe for America. They've bought into the propaganda that the terrorists are waiting at the New York Harbor or at the mouth of San Francisco Bay or in the Gulf of off Texas, that they think terrorists and people wanting to harm them are just waiting for the moment to arrive, and they're terrified. Our propaganda system has terrified people and has raised the fear level to such that people are willing to accept things that they would not ordinarily accept. And the way to combat that is to try to help people understand what it's like to live in a country like Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, where drones are dropping daily, and understand on a daily basis what the life of a family is like, and to understand what the life of a drone operator is, and to understand why people get involved in the drone program. The emotional attachment to the issue of safety is so very strong, and the propaganda arm of this country is so very strong, that giving information is not enough. You need to really appeal to the emotional level. And then there are appeals to religious beliefs, where killing is wrong, that we have to respect the lives of others. And I'm sure Jerry, who's more attached to the Catholic Church, can speak to that. But it's not easy. It's not easy. And the other thing that I often do is I go back in history and bring up examples where we've been lied to. And that's one of the major things that has gone on in this country, is that there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of lying. Go back to talking about, for example, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, where we went into Vietnam because we were lied to. Go back to the connection between Iraq and uranium, between Niger and Iraq and the United States. That was a lie. And to continue to bring up falsehoods that have been perpetuated and which have brought us to war and which continue to engage us in war. And those are some of the things that I do. And I just, in the end, appeal to humanity. And the truth is that sometimes all you can do is give information, have the discussion, and hope that at some point later, either the discussion continues or that the person you've been talking to is thinking about it. And in the end, you have to say to yourself, every time you have a discussion with somebody, you may not change your mind and they may not change their mind, but you hope that the other person's thinking about it. And I try to think about what they've said to me.
So one of the things I like to do is I like to tell people what my friend Kathy Kelly told me once. In Houston, it rains a lot. And there are days where it doesn't rain, but we have overcast all day. And so I often tell people what Kathy told me. And what she told me was that when the skies are gray, the drones refuse to fly. When the skies are blue, kids run and cry. And what she was talking about was in Afghanistan, she was once told by one of the Afghan peace volunteers that the only time kids actually go out to play is when the skies are gray, because they know that the drones won't be out. But when the skies are blue, they cry because they're afraid that somebody's going to die. So I often tell people, I say, if you want to experience what it's like to live under drones, don't go outside when it's sunny. Stay inside your house. And when it's overcast or when it rains, then you can go out and start living your life and see the subtle difference. That's what Afghan children and other children in other countries that we have drone have to live with on a daily basis, the fear of when the sun is out and it's a beautiful day and they want to go out and play, that they can't because they're afraid that they're going to not come back home later in the day. So I like to use that image because it, for Houstonians, because of our weather patterns, that relates to a lot of people. But also I do like pointing out, because I think there's a correlation between the support for drones and the support for guns in this state. And that correlation is that the people who support militarized drones and who support the idea that everybody should be armed with guns to defend themselves comes out of a place of fear. Fear and mistrust. I think we have been taught very well in this society because of propaganda and war games and so on that it's okay to cower in fear most of our lives and to not trust everybody and that we should be suspicious of every person and every place that we go to. And the only people we should support are not be suspicious of are people who are armed because somehow that would protect us. I often bring up, because this is Texas and it's a highly religious state, and Houston's a very religiously diverse city, I often bring up to my friends who are Christian who believe in drones and guns that if we claim to be a follower of Jesus, we can't be people of fear. Throughout the scripture, Jesus said over 360 times, "Be not afraid." We're supposed to put our trust in the resurrection, the resurrection of life, not in death. And so I bring up that point and the point about playing outside when it's the sky are gray, because I like to make the human connection that the people who are being killed, the kids, are the same ages as the kids that are here in this country. And that those kids who are being killed every day have mothers and fathers who love them just as you may love your son or daughter or nephew or niece or cousin or grandkids. And so I think the human connection is also important. I like to show pictures of kids or family members who have lost family or been made victims of drone attacks and say, you know, this easily could be one of your relatives if the tables were turned. And so I think the human connection is very, very important. Making the correlation between how we're being taught to fear instead of learn how to trust, and understanding that we have to begin to learn to disarm ourselves. And to do that, we have to begin to create new ways of living and being with each other. And I think the beginning process of that is to begin dialogue, to show up and be seen and be accounted for, and to start questioning, disrupting business as usual and saying, hey, no, we're not doing this because we're against you. We're doing this because we're actually for you. We're for your life. We're for the lives of those who are being attacked every day. And because we want to say, hey, there's a better way of being. So let's start experimenting with that and living that way.
Wow, thank you for articulating all that, Jerry. We are getting into the last very few minutes of the show, and I want to remind our listeners that that was Jerry Monroe Maynard that we just heard from. He is the organizer of Campaign Nonviolence in Houston, Catholic peace activist, and a member of FOR USA. We've also been speaking with Eleanor Levine, who is a longtime activist with Code Pink Women for Peace and works on militarism both here in our own country and overseas. Eleanor, I want to invite you to speak first to just give your last comments for the listeners that you'd like them to go out from this show thinking about.
Well, the first thing I'd say is thank you for listening. This is an important show, and shows like this are important. The second thing I'd say is educate, read, educate, read. The third thing I'd say is question authority. That is, when you hear something, ask yourself, is it true? How do I know it's true? Who's speaking? Is there an alternative? And in whose interest is that piece of information? And the fourth thing I'd say is that the members of our military mostly are there because there are not alternatives in their lives. That very often when we talk to the members of the military at Creech Air Force Base and Beale Air Force Base, because we do talk to them, they tell us that they joined the military because there was no other way out of their community. There were no jobs. They had a girlfriend. The girlfriend got pregnant. They got married. They were young. They needed job training, that they were misled, join the military, see the world, get a job, and so on and so forth. And we live in a society where there are often no alternatives to the military. And I think as activists, we really need to understand that And we have to work not only against warfare and bringing peace, but about changing the domestic policies at home so that people don't have to join the military as the only alternative to a sane and healthy life.
Thank you for saying that, Eleanor. Jerry, I'd love to hear your last comment, and also if you could tell the listeners where they can connect to more information, if they're curious, if they're ready to engage, if they want to learn more, where can they find that?
So I think my final thoughts would be, I encourage everybody to begin to start showing up, make it a daily habit to show up to your city council, your state representatives, to weekly demonstrations and vigils, and show up and be seen and show people who are being oppressed that you're in solidarity with them. Educate yourself, agitate the passive, and really begin to start supporting local systems. And lastly, I think to get involved, I suggest everybody go to shutdowncreech.blogspot.com to get info about what we do at Shutdown Creech. Start resisting and start showing up and really, really invest time and energy and efforts into helping to create a new world where we are free from war, violence, and domination.
Thank you both so much for joining us today and for helping us to share with our listeners this important information. I think that as we move forward, we have to realize that every place is our place, and that wherever there's crisis in the world, there is crisis within our own lives, because we are all connected. So thank you so much for this important and thoughtful discussion today.
I need you to be loved, 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 loved and revolution.
Thanks this week to our guests, Eleanor Levine and Jerry Monroe Maynard, for helping us to gain a greater understanding of the use of drones, both within warfare and within our civil society, an important subject for us all to be thinking about. And I'd also like to thank my sunny and warm co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun, for helping to bring light to all of these discussions that we have each week. And our theme song, Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson, is performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And thank you, Sherry, for joining me week after week and for always going down into the roots and the values that underlie the problems and issues that we're facing in our world today. If you listeners were enjoying her approach to some of these questions and conversations, you will probably like to check out her Sacred Instructions Facebook page, the link to which you can find on the Love and Revolution page and on the podcast. We have a Love and Revolution Facebook page, so check it out. Give us a like. This is a weekly radio program that can be broadcasted on your local radio station. And if you just contact your station manager, they can help you get that into their rotation usually. We can be reached via the Love and Revolution page on my website, www.riverasun.com, and we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Sherry Mitchell. Today we had an engaging discussion about the use of drones within our societies. It's important for us to consider how the use of drone warfare has distanced us from the responsibility and from the consequences of our actions. It's also distanced us from the consequences of the actions of our governments, which are taken in our name. As the use of drones proliferates throughout the world, the chances that those consequences are going to come home and impact us and our families the way that they are impacting other families around the world grows daily. In order for us to be able to address the issues that are being wrought in the world in our name, then we have to start taking responsibility for the things that are being done in the world with our consent, whether that consent be silent or active. So I encourage you all to look around, to look at the ways that your government is acting in your name, and start thinking about how you can influence the decisions that are being made, how you can start voicing your concerns about the way that others in the world are being harmed in your name. And also to talk to your neighbors and help them to understand the actions that are being taken around the world that are impacting families just like yours and mine. So a little challenge for you listeners, see if you can do all of those things by the time we talk to you next week.